A little over 2 years ago, Governor Andrew Cuomo signed legislation billed as the Red Flag Law, a nation-leading measure that was designed to prevent New Yorkers who are a clear threat to themselves or others from possessing any kind of firearm, and empowered educators to pursue a court action that would get weapons, at least temporarily, out of a home. In the waning days of the legislative session this year, state lawmakers approved a bill that builds on those gun safety measures by promoting more awareness about extreme risk protection orders. For more on the proposed evolution of the law, we're joined by the bill's sponsor, Assemblymember Amy Paulin, a Westchester County Democrat. Welcome back to the show, Assemblymember.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So for starters, can you give us a little bit of a refresher course on how the state's Red Flag Law currently works now with regards to invoking extreme risk protection orders?
Well, you have to actually go to court, right? You have to initiate yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to decide that that's something that you believe or a family member believes would protect you from suicide. It's really it's mostly about suicide. I guess it could be if you think you're going to harm someone else, you want to temporarily prevent yourself from getting a gun. But it's all about you deciding that you or a family member believes that you need to protect you or someone else from your obtaining a gun. So it's really been very successful, and I think it can be very successful. The problem is we have to make sure that people know about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, right, and that's what this bill is about.
Yeah, your bill specifically deals with awareness, I guess, promoted by mental health facilities. Can you walk us through what they would be required to do if your bill became law?
Currently, there's two ways to go into a mental facility, voluntarily and by force, essentially, you know, because the community believes you're a threat to yourself or someone else. So if it's not voluntarily, you automatically go on, your name goes into the next database. So you're prevented from obtaining a gun. If it's voluntary, which is in the case of many, many people, just because of the way the system is set up, you're not in that database.
And can you explain what the NICS database is?
So what the NICS database is, it's the database that's used for anyone where there's a reason you shouldn't get a gun. There's about 10 prohibitors that the federal government have identified. You know, I know we're going to talk soon about fugitive from justice, right? But there's many, there's prohibitors that you've committed a crime, actually terrorist isn't on there, it should be, but there's prohibitors that would not enable you to obtain a gun. And so in order to prevent someone under this scenario, red flag, your name would be entered into the NICS database. So that's what it really is.
I thought it was interesting the root of this legislation, which really stems from a tragic incident in Westchester. Can you walk us through what happened?
Yeah. Well, this is a terrible situation. It happened to be a woman who lived in my district, and she had suicidal tendencies. She was voluntarily admitted into psychiatric unit. And when she came out, you know, her family didn't think she was all well. However, her name was not, because she was voluntarily admitted, not in the NICS database. And she bought a gun and she killed herself. So if the family had known, they knew that they needed to help her through this hard time, they would have used the red flag law. And so when they found out about it, they were just distraught, because they knew there was something out there that could have prevented their loved one from killing themselves.
Under this bill, then, are you saying that someone would be automatically prohibited from or would they basically become aware of this red flag
law? They would become aware. The group that's prohibited automatically, you know, that's if the agency or hospital or whatever submits the names, because there's some gaps there too. But it's the people who are involuntarily admitted. You know, most people are voluntarily admitted. You know, that's the norm. So most people who are committed to a psychiatric unit and are viewed as someone who might do harm to themselves or others are not in the NICS database. So it's really for that population more so for the than the involuntary, because they are automatically put onto that database.
So would they get, I don't know, a pamphlet saying that there's
that's
this
the
option?
Vision. That's the vision, that they would get some kind of pamphlet or even a sheet of paper explaining, you know, but just some information as to what it is, how to proceed, and to be aware, so that if they think their family member could use that additional support, and or the person themselves thinks they can, they're aware that it exists.
And in the case that you just talked about, the husband of the woman who committed suicide has since said that he would have secured an extreme risk protection order if he had known it was an option. What happens, though, if the person who is leaving a mental health facility after a voluntary stay decides they don't want that information about the red flag law distributed, for whatever reason, to their spouse or children? Can the mental health facility still proactively distribute information about the law to the person's caregivers, or do they have to acknowledge that person's request and not distribute a pamphlet or whatever it might be?
I think it's just a handout, you know, for like there's probably other things that are given to someone and their family. It's just information. It doesn't mean anyone has to take advantage of it or use it in any way. You know, so it's just information. It doesn't require anything.
You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking about efforts to combat gun violence by controlling who has access to guns. And our guest is Assemblymember Amy Paulin. So far, what's your sense of the use of the red flag law? Because when it was adopted, it was really billed as a means to prevent mass shootings, domestic incidents, and suicides, really things that stem from maybe a mental health episode. Do you have any
indication? I haven't indication heard of many cases where it's been used. I don't know that there's any data being collected. There probably should be. I always worried when we were passing it that, you know, it would be underutilized because of people being unaware. You know, so that's why I did this bill, because I think this is a population everybody knows. You know, everybody look out there when a mass shooting occurs, oh, the person had mental illness, we should have been aware, right? Well, this is a case where there are people with mental illness, and if they themselves or their family members become aware of this law, they could take advantage of it and maybe prevent some of those tragedies. There has to be more awareness, and that's really what the goal of the legislation is about.
Turning to another bill that you got through the legislature this year, there's a measure that basically clears up some conflicting opinions about the ability of someone to purchase a firearm while knowing there's an outstanding warrant out for their arrest stemming from a serious offense or felony. Can you explain the root of the disagreement there and how your bill resolves that?
Yes, it's very interesting. There was a dispute between the ATF and the FBI, the ATF being the agency that is charged with guns, so to speak. I mean, it's, you know, if there's a problem, you know, they do the inspections of the gun dealers. If they would follow up, if there's someone who, after the waiting period, got a gun inappropriately, they would be in charge of trying to get that gun back, right? And that's the part that I want to focus on for this conversation. Because mm-hmm. So the dispute was the FBI, who was in charge of the NICS database that we talked about and is in charge of figuring out the background checks of people, the dispute was that the FBI believed that one of the prohibitors identified in federal law is a fugitive from justice. And what that means is just like what it says, right? They're running away from a court system that's trying to bring them back for whatever reason. They committed some kind of crime. They avoided their court appearance, what have you. They're a fugitive from justice. And what the FBI read the law to mean is that if you committed a murder, right, and you didn't appear in court and you lived and you're a fugitive from justice, no matter where you live, no matter where you've gone, whether it's next door to your house or in your house or whether it's in another state. And the ATF said, no, it's only if they literally are a fugitive, if they have gone out of the state, out of New they both have very good lawyers in their departments, and their lawyers had a dispute. And it was finally resolved in 2017. And the way it was resolved was that the ATF essentially won the argument. But having said that, what happened now in New York is if there's a warrant out for someone, someone doesn't appear in court and there's a warrant out for their arrest, or they have identified this person as having committed a crime and the person is avoiding being apprehended by the police, there's a warrant, right? There's a warrant for various things. So there's a warrant out for their arrest and they're a fugitive from justice, but they're in New York or they're in New Jersey. How do you know? So you don't know.
Right.
So what happened as a result is that because they didn't know and they couldn't put people who were inside the state into the NICS database, DCJS, who is responsible for having that action, for actually putting the names into the database, they stopped doing it altogether. So anybody who had an outstanding warrant, no matter what the warrant was, it could have been for a violent crime. It could have been for a domestic violence crime where there was a gun involved. It could have been for any crime, or it was for any crime, and they were not in the database. And they could just absolutely buy a gun without anybody saying no. So it was a very important loophole to correct, because what we're talking about here are people who have committed a crime or have avoided their court appearance. The federal government has already said that, you know, if you're a fugitive from justice, you should not have a gun. This was preventing us from essentially following the federal law because of the confusion in the federal law. And I would, you know, and so this is a way for us to straighten it out. We now are aligned with what the FBI thought it was to begin with until the federal government does what they need to do.
If these bills can save even one person from a tragic, preventable gun death or prevent maybe a murder, then it's obviously worthwhile protection to implement. But, you know, at a time when I guess more than 500 people have been shot this year already in New York and more than 80 of those people end up being killed, do you ever feel like the state and I guess our country as a whole is just kind of working around the margins when it comes to preventing gun violence?
There's no question that they're working around the margins. I mean, it's a shame because, you know, the bills that we have really promoted in New York, they're not preventing any law-abiding citizen from getting a gun. You know, they are simply preventing guns from getting in the wrong hands. There's such a concern that somehow we're going to take someone's gun away. Well, sometimes we need to take someone's gun away in order to prevent harm to someone else. And, you know, until we all come together and we rationally talk about those things, we're going to have too many guns in too many hands and hurting too many people.
Right now, one of New York's gun laws is going to be heard by the Supreme Court in October. And I guess I'm curious, as someone who's trying to promote a lot of gun safety measures, whether you're worried that New York is going to be really hamstrung in the future based on what the U.S. Supreme Court might decide in this case and other future Second Amendment cases based on the conservative leaning of this court's makeup?
Well, you know, there's been a lot of court cases already decided. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're very much in line with those. The court right now has acknowledged that you can prevent, you know, people who shouldn't have guns from having guns. And as long as they stay along those lines, all of New York's laws will be upheld. You know, so I am. I watch it. I tend to be an optimist, you know. So, but I'm obviously we're watching it to make sure. I mean, we've had a couple of times. You know, there was that the New York City case, and we had to change the law to make sure that we were in compliance. But we were able to do that. So, I think we'll be able to adjust. But I tend to be an optimist, and I believe that people do not want guns in the hands of people who can harm others.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave things there. We've been speaking with Assemblymember Amy Paulin, a Westchester County Democrat. Assemblymember, thank you so much for making the time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.